4. The difference between broad intention and detailed application is particularly clear in the reconstruction of the international economy, for here the lesson of the great slump, the word constantly appears in the discourse of the 1940s, were at least partly translated into concrete institutional arrangements. U.S. supremacy was, of course, a fact. The political pressure for action came from Washington, even when many of the ideas and initiatives came from Britain, and where opinions differed, as between Keynes and the American spokesman Harry White over the new International Monetary Fund, IMF, the U.S. view prevailed. Yet the original plan for the new liberal economic world order envisaged it as part of a new international political order, also planned during the last war years as the United Nations, and it was not until the original model of the UN collapsed in the Cold War that the only two international institutions actually set up under the Bretton Woods agreements of 1944, the World Bank, International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and the IMF, both still in existence, became de facto subordinated to US policy. They were to foster long-term international investment and maintain exchange stability as well, dealing with balance of payments problems. Other points on the international program did not generate special institutions, for example, for controlling the price of primary commodities and for international measures to maintain full employment, or were only incompletely implemented. The proposed International Trade Organization ended up as the much more modest General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, a framework for reducing trade barriers by periodic bargaining. In short, insofar as the planners of the Brave New World tried to construct a set of working institutions to give their projects reality, they failed. The world did not emerge from the war in the shape of a working international system of multilateral free trade and payments, and the American moves to establish it broke down within 2 years of victory. And yet, unlike the United Nations, the international system of trade and payments worked, though not in the way originally predicted or intended. In practice, the Golden Age was the era of free trade, free capital movements, and stable currencies that had been in the minds of the wartime planners. No doubt, this was due primarily to the overwhelming economic dominance of the USA and of the dollar, which functioned all the better as a stabilizer because it was linked to a specific quantity of gold, until the system broke down in the late 1960s and early 1970s. One must constantly bear in mind that in 1950, the USA alone contained 60% or so of all the capital stock of all the advanced capitalist countries, produced 60% or so of all their output, and even at the peak of the Golden Age, 1970, still held over 50% of the total capital stock of all these countries and produced almost half their output. It was also due to the fear of communism. For, contrary to American convictions, the chief obstacle to a free-trading international capitalist economy was not the protectionist instincts of foreigners, but the combination of traditional U.S. high tariffs at home and the drive for a vast expansion of American exports, which the wartime planners in Washington regarded as essential to the attainment of full and effective employment in the USA. Aggressive expansion was plainly in the minds of American policymakers as soon as the war was over. It was the Cold War which encouraged them to take a longer view, by persuading them that helping their future competitors to grow as rapidly as possible was politically urgent. It has even been argued that in this manner the Cold War was the major engine of the great global boom. This is probably an exaggeration, but the gigantic largesse of Marshall Aid certainly helped the modernization of such recipients as wanted to use it for this purpose, as Austria and France did systematically, and American aid was decisive in speeding up the transformation of West Germany and Japan. No doubt these two countries would have become great economic powers in any case. The mere fact that, as defeated states, they were not masters of their foreign policy gave them an advantage, since it did not tempt them into pouring more than a minimum of resources into the barren hole of military spending. Nevertheless, we have only to ask what would have happened to the German economy if its recovery had depended on the Europeans, who feared its revival. How fast would the Japanese economy have recovered if the USA had not found itself building up Japan as the industrial base for the Korean War and again the Vietnam War after 1965? America funded the doubling of Japan's manufacturing output between 1949 and 1953, And it is no accident that 1966 to 1970 were the years of peak Japanese growth, no less than 14.6% per annum. The role of the Cold War is thus not to be underestimated, even if the long-term economic effect of the vast diversion of resources by states into competitive armaments was damaging. In the extreme case of the USSR, it was probably fatal. However, even the USA traded off military strength against growing economic weakness. A capitalist world economy thus developed round the USA. It raised fewer obstacles to the international movements of factors of production than any other since the mid-Victorian period, with one exception. International migration was slow to recover from interwar strangulation. This was partly an optical illusion. The great Golden Age boom was fueled not only by the labour of the formerly unemployed, but by vast flows of internal migration from country to city, from farming, especially out of regions of poor upland soils, from poorer to richer regions. So Italian southerners flooded into the factories of Lombardy and Piedmont, and 400,000 Tuscan sharecroppers left their holdings in 20 years. The industrialization of Eastern Europe was essentially such a process of mass migration. Moreover, some of these internal migrants were actually international migrants, except that they had originally arrived in the receiving country not as seekers for employment, but as part of the terrible mass exodus of refugees and expelled populations after 1945. Nevertheless, it is notable that in an era of spectacular economic growth and increasing labour shortage, and in Western world dedicated to free movements in the economy, governments resisted free immigration, and when they found themselves actually permitting it, as in the case of the Caribbean and other inhabitants of the British Commonwealth who had the right to settle because they were legally British, put a stop to it. In many cases, such immigrants, mostly from the less developed Mediterranean countries, were only allowed conditional and temporary residence, so that they could be easily repatriated, although the expansion of the European Economic Community to include several emigrant countries, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, made this harder. Still, by the early 1970s, about 7.5 million had migrated into the developed European countries. Even in the Golden Age, immigration was a politically sensitive issue. In the difficult decades after 1973, it was to lead to a sharp rise in public xenophobia in Europe. However, the world economy in the Golden Age remained international rather than transnational. Countries traded with each other to an ever greater extent. Even the USA, which had been largely self-supplying before the Second World War, quadrupled its exports to the rest of the world between 1950 and 1970, but it also became a massive importer of consumer goods from the late 1950s on. In the late 1960s, it even began to import automobiles. Yet, though the industrial economies increasingly bought and sold each other's production, the bulk of their economic activities remained home-centered. At the peak of the Golden Age, the USA exported only just under 8% of its GDP, and more surprisingly, export-oriented Japan only a little more. Nevertheless, an increasingly transnational economy began to emerge, especially from the 1960s on, that is to say, a system of economic activities for which state territories and state frontiers are not the basic framework, but merely complicating factors. In the extreme case, a world economy comes into existence which actually has no specifiable territorial base or limits, and which determines, or rather sets limits to, what even the economies of very large and powerful states can do. Sometime in the early 1970s, such a transnational economy became an effective global force. It continued to grow, if anything more rapidly than before, during the crisis decades after 1973. Indeed, its emergence largely created the problems of these decades. Of course, it went hand in hand with a growing internationalization. Between 1965 and 1990, the percentage of the world's product which went in exports was to double. Three aspects of this transnationalization were particularly obvious. Transnational firms, often known as multinationals, the new international division of labour, and the rise of offshore finance. The last of these was not only one of the earliest forms of transnationalism to develop, but also the one which demonstrates most vividly the way in which the capitalist economy escaped from national or any other control. the term offshore entered civilian public vocabulary sometime in the 1960s to describe the practice of registering the legal seat of businesses in some usually tiny and fiscally generous territory, which permitted entrepreneurs to avoid the taxes and other constraints imposed on them by their own country. For every serious state or territory, however committed to the freedom of profit-making, had by the mid-century established certain controls and restrictions on the conduct of legitimate business in the interests of its people. A suitably complex and ingenious combination of the legal loopholes in the corporate and labour laws of kindly mini-territories, for instance Curaçao, the Virgin Islands and Liechtenstein, could do wonders for a firm's balance sheet. For the essence of offshoreness lies in turning an enormous number of loopholes into a viable but unregulated corporate structure. For obvious reasons, offshoreness lent itself particularly to financial transactions, although Panama and Liberia had long subsidized their politicians by the income from registering the merchant ships of other countries, whose owners found their native labor and safety regulations too onerous. Sometime in the 1960s, a little ingenuity turned the old international financial centre, the City of London, into a major global offshore centre by the invention of eurocurrency, that is to say, mainly eurodollars. Dollars held on deposit in non-US banks and not repatriated, mainly to avoid the restrictions of US banking law, became a negotiable financial instrument. These free-floating dollars, accumulating in huge quantities thanks to the growing American investments abroad and the enormous political and military expenditures of the US government, became the foundation of an entirely uncontrolled global market, mainly in short-term loans. Its rise was quite dramatic. The net euro currency market rose from perhaps $14 billion in 1964 to perhaps $160 billion in 1973, and almost $500 billion 5 years later, when this market became the main mechanism for recycling the Klondike of oil profits, which the OPEC countries suddenly found themselves wondering how to spend and invest. The USA was the first country to find itself at the mercy of these vast, multiplying floods of unattached capital that washed round the globe from currency to currency, looking for quick profits. Eventually, all governments were to be its victims, since they lost control over exchange rates and the world money supply. By the early 1990s, even joint action by leading central banks proved impotent. That firms based in one country but operating in several should expand their activities was natural enough. Nor were such multinationals new. The US corporations of this kind raised their foreign affiliates from about 7,500 in 1950 to over 23,000 in 1966, mostly in Western Europe and the Western Hemisphere. However, increasingly other countries' firms followed. The German chemical corporation, Hirsch, for instance, established or associated itself with 117 plants in 45 countries, in all but 6 cases after 1950. The novelty lay rather in the sheer scale of operations of these transnational entities. By the early 1980s, US transnational corporations accounted for over 3/4 of their country's exports and almost half its imports. And such corporations, both British and foreign, were responsible for over 80% of British exports. In one sense, these are irrelevant figures, since the main function of such corporations was to internalize markets across national frontiers, that is to say, to make themselves independent of the state and its territory. Much of what the statistics, which are still basically collected country by country, show as imports or exports, is in fact internal trade within a transnational entity such as General Motors, which operated in 40 countries. The ability to operate in this manner naturally reinforced the tendency for capital to concentrate, familiar since Karl Marx. By 1960, it was already estimated that the sales of the 200 largest firms in the non-socialist world were the equivalent of 17% of the GNP of that sector of the world, and by 1984 they were said to amount to 26%. Most of such transnationals were based in substantial developed states. In fact, 85% of the big 200 were based in the USA, Japan, Britain, and Germany, with firms from 11 other countries making up the rest. Yet, even if the links of such supergiants with their native governments were likely to close, by the end of the Golden Age, it is doubtful whether any of them, except the Japanese ones and some essentially military firms, could be confidently described as identified with their governments' or nations' interests. It was no longer as clear as it had once seemed that, in the words of a Detroit tycoon who entered the US government, what's good for General Motors is good for the USA. How could it be when their operations in the home country were merely those in one market of the 100 in which, say, Mobil Oil was active, or the 170 in which Daimler-Benz was present? Business logic would force an international oil firm to calculate its strategy and policy towards its native country in exactly the same way as towards Saudi Arabia or Venezuela, namely in terms of profit and loss on one hand, of the comparative power of company and government on the other. The tendency for business transactions and business enterprises, and by no means only those of a few score of giants, to emancipate themselves from the traditional nation-state became even more marked as industrial production began, slowly at first but with growing speed, to move out of the European and North American countries that had pioneered industrialization and capitalist development. These countries remained the powerhouse of Golden Age growth. In the middle 1950s, the industrial countries had sold about 3/5 of their manufactured exports to each other. In the early 1970s, 3/4. However, then things began to change. The developed world began to export somewhat more of its manufactures to the rest of the world, but more significantly, the Third World began to export manufactures to the developed industrial countries on a substantial scale. As the traditional primary exports of backward regions lost ground, except after the OPEC revolution mineral fuels, they began, patchily but rapidly, to industrialize. Between 1970 and 1983, the Third World's share of global industrial exports, hitherto stable at about 5%, more than doubled. A new international division of labor therefore began to undermine the old one. The German firm Volkswagen set up car factories in Argentina, Brazil, 3 plants, Canada, Ecuador, Egypt, Mexico, Nigeria, Peru, South Africa and Yugoslavia, as usually, mainly after the mid-1960s. New Third World industries supplied not only the swelling local markets, but also the world market. They could do this both by exporting articles completely produced by local industry, such as textiles, most of which had by 1970 already emigrated from the old countries to the developing ones, and by becoming part of a transnational process of manufacture. This was the decisive innovation of the Golden Age, though it did not fully come into its own until later. It could not have happened but for the revolution in transport and communication, which made it possible and economically feasible to split the production of a single article between, say, Houston, Singapore, and Thailand, air freighting the partly completed product between these centres and controlling the entire process centrally by modern information technology. Major electronics producers began to globalise themselves from the mid-1960s. The line of production now moved not through gigantic hangars on a single site, but across the globe. Some of them stopped in the extraterritorial free production zones or offshore plants which now began to spread overwhelmingly in poor countries with cheap and mainly young women's labour, another and new device for escaping the control of a single state. Thus, one of the earliest, Manaus, deep in the Amazonian jungle, manufactured textiles, toys, paper goods, electronics and digital watches for US, Dutch and Japanese firms. All this produced a paradoxical change in the political structure of the world economy. As the globe became its real unit, the national economies of the large states found themselves giving way to such offshore centres, mostly situated in the small or tiny mini-states which had conveniently multiplied as the old colonial empires fell apart. At the end of the short 20th century, the world, according to the World Bank, contained 71 economies with populations of less than 2.5 million, 18 of them with populations of less than 100,000. That is to say, 2/5 of all the political units officially treated as economies. Until the Second World War, such units had been regarded as economic jokes, and indeed not real states at all. They were and are certainly incapable of defending their nominal independence in the international jungle, but in the Golden Age, it became evident that they could flourish as well as, and sometimes better than, large national economies by providing services directly to the global economy. Hence the rise of new city-states, Hong Kong, Singapore, a form of polity last seen to flourish in the Middle Ages. Patches of Persian Gulf desert were transformed into major players on the global investment market, Kuwait, and of the many offshore refuges from state law. This situation was to provide the multiplying ethnic movements of late 20th century nationalism with unconvincing arguments for the viability of an independent Corsica or Canary Islands. Unconvincing because the only independence achieved by secession was that of separation from the nation-state with which such territories had previously been associated. Economically, separation would almost certainly make them more dependent on the transnational entities which increasingly determined such matters. The most convenient world for multinational giants is one populated by dwarf states or no states at all. 5. It was natural that industry should shift from high cost to cheap labour locations as soon as this became technically possible and cost effective, and the hardly surprising discovery that some non-white labour forces were at least as skilled and educated as white ones was to be an additional bonus for high-tech industries. Yet there was a particularly convincing reason why the Golden Age boom should lead to a shift away from the core countries of the old industrialisation. This was the peculiar Keynesian combination of economic growth in a capitalist economy based on the mass consumption of a fully employed and increasingly well-paid and well-protected labour force. The combination was, as we have seen, a political construct. It rested on an effective policy consensus between right and left in most Western countries, the extreme fascist ultra-nationalist right having been eliminated from the political scene by the Second World War, the extreme communist left by the Cold War. It was also based on a tacit or explicit consensus between employers and labour organisations to keep labour demands within limits that did not eat into the profits, and the future prospects of profits high enough to justify the huge investments without which the spectacular growth of Golden Age labour productivity could not have taken place. Indeed, in the 16 most industrial of the market economies, investment grew at an annual rate of 4.5%, about three times as fast as during the years from 1870 to 1913, even allowing for the rather less impressive rate in North America, which pushed the general average down. De facto, the arrangement was triangular, with governments, formally or informally, presiding over the institutionalized negotiations between capital and labor, who are now habitually described, at least in Germany, as the social partners. After the end of the Golden Age, these arrangements were savagely assailed by the rising free market theologians under the name of corporatism, a word which had half forgotten and entirely irrelevant associations with interwar fascism. This was a deal acceptable to all sides. Employers, who hardly minded high wages during a long boom with high profits, welcomed the predictability which made forward planning easier. Labour got regularly rising wages and fringe benefits and a steadily extended and more generous welfare state. Government got political stability, weakening communist parties, except in Italy, and predictable conditions for the macroeconomic management which all states now practiced. And the economies of the industrial capitalist countries did splendidly, if only because for the first time, outside North America and perhaps Australasia, an economy of mass consumption came into existence on the basis of full employment and regularly rising real incomes, buttressed by social security, which in time was paid for by rising public revenues. Indeed, in the euphoric 1960s, some incautious governments went so far as to guarantee the unemployed, who were then few, 80% of their former wage. Until the late 1960s, the politics of the Golden Age reflected this state of affairs. The war was followed everywhere by strongly reformist governments, Rooseveltian in the USA, socialist-dominated or social-democratic in virtually all ex-belligerent Western Europe, except in occupied West Germany, where there were neither independent institutions nor elections until 1949. Even the communists were in government until 1947. The radicalism of the resistance years affected even the emerging conservative parties, the West German Christian Democrats thought capitalism was bad for Germany as late as 1949, or at least made it hard to swim against the tide. The British Conservative Party claimed credit for the reforms of the Labour government of 1945. Somewhat surprisingly, reformism soon retreated, though not the consensus. The great boom of the 1950s was presided over, almost everywhere, by governments of moderate conservatives. In the USA from 1952, in Britain from 1951, in France, except for brief episodes of coalition, West Germany, Italy and Japan, the left was entirely out of power, though Scandinavia remained social democratic and socialist parties were in government coalitions in other small countries. There can be no doubt about the recession of the left. This was not due to any massive loss of support by the socialists or even the communists in France and Italy, where they were the major working class party. Nor, except perhaps in Germany, where the Social Democratic Party, SPD, was unsound on German unity, and in Italy, where it remained allied to the communists, was it due to the Cold War. Everybody, except for the communists, was reliably anti-Russian. The mood of the booming decade was against the left. This was not a time for change. In the 1960s, the centre of gravity of the consensus shifted towards the left, perhaps partly due to the increasing retreat of economic liberalism before Keynesian management, even in anti-collectivist holdouts like Belgium and West Germany, perhaps in part because the elderly gentlemen who had presided over the stabilisation and revival of the capitalist system left the scene. Dwight Eisenhower, born 1890, in 1960. Konrad Adenauer, born 1876, in 1965. Harold Macmillan, born 1894, in 1964. Eventually, 1969, even the great General de Gaulle, born 1890, departed. A certain rejuvenation of politics took place. In fact, the peak years of the Golden Age seemed to be as congenial to the moderate left, once again in government in many West European states, as the 1950s had been uncongenial. This drift to the left was partly due to electoral shifts, as in West Germany, Austria and Sweden, and anticipated even more striking shifts in the 1970s and early 1980s, when both the French socialists and the Italian communists reached their all-time peaks, but essentially voting patterns remained stable. Electoral systems exaggerated relatively minor shifts. However, there is a clear parallelism between the shift to the left and the most significant public developments of the decade, namely the appearance of welfare states in the literal meaning of the word, that is to say, states in which welfare expenditures, income maintenance, care, education and so on, became the greater part of total public expenditure, and people engaged in welfare activities formed the largest body of all public employment. For example, in the middle of the 1970s, 40% in Britain and 47% in Sweden. The first welfare states in this sense appeared round 1970. Of course, the decline of military expenditure during the détente years automatically raised the proportion of spending under other headings, but the example of the USA shows that there was a real change. In 1970, while the Vietnam War was at its height, the number of school employees in the USA for the first time became significantly larger than the number of military and civilian defense personnel. By the end of the 1970s, all advanced capitalist states had become such welfare states, with six states spending more than 60% of total public outlays for welfare: Australia, Belgium, France, West Germany, Italy, Netherlands. This was to produce considerable problems after the end of the Golden Age. Meanwhile, the politics of developed market economies seemed tranquil, if not somnolent. What was there to get impassioned about except communism, the dangers of nuclear war, and the crises imported into their affairs by imperial activities abroad, such as the Suez Adventure of 1956 in Britain, the Algerian War in France, 1954 to 1961, and, after 1965, the Vietnam War in the USA. That was the reason why the sudden and almost worldwide spurt of student radicalism in and around 1968 took politicians and older intellectuals so much by surprise. It was a sign that the Golden Age balance could not last. Economically, this balance depended on a coordination between the growth of productivity and earnings, which kept profits stable. a sag in the continuous rise of productivity and/or a disproportionate rise in wages would result in destabilization. It depended on what had been so dramatically absent between the wars, a balance between the growth of production and the ability of consumers to buy it. Wages had to rise fast enough to keep the market buoyant, but not fast enough to squeeze profits. But how to control wages in an era of labour shortage, or more generally, prices in a time of exceptionally booming demand? How, in other words, to control inflation, or at least keep it within bounds? Lastly, the Golden Age depended on the overwhelming political and economic dominance of the USA, which acted, sometimes without meaning to, as the stabiliser and guarantor of the world economy. In the course of the 1960s, all these showed signs of wear and tear. The hegemony of the USA declined, and as it slipped, the gold dollar-based world monetary system broke down. There were some signs of slowdown in labour productivity in several countries, and certainly signs that the great labour reservoir of internal migration, which had fed the industrial boom, was close to exhaustion. After 20 years, a new generation had become adult, for whom interwar experience, mass unemployment, insecurity, stable or falling prices, were history and not part of experience. They had adjusted their expectations to the only experience of their age group, that of full employment and continuous inflation. Whatever the specific situation which triggered the worldwide wage explosion at the end of the 1960s, labour shortage, growing efforts by employers to hold down real wages, or, as in France and Italy, the great student rebellions, all of them rested on the discovery by a generation of workers who had got used to having or finding work that the regular and welcome rises so long negotiated by their unions were actually much less than could be screwed out of the market. Whether or not we detect a return to class struggle in this recognition of market realities, as many in the post-1968 New Left held, there is no doubt about the striking change of mood between the moderation and calm of wage negotiations before 1968 and the last years of the Golden Age. Since it was directly relevant to the way the economy worked, the shift in labour's mood was far more significant than the great burst of student unrest in and around 1968, though the students provided more dramatic material for the media and far more food for the commentators. The student rebellion was a phenomenon outside economics and politics. It mobilised a particular minority sector of the population, as yet barely recognised as a special group in public life, and, since most of its members were still being educated, largely outside the economy, except as purchasers of rock records, the middle-class youth. Its cultural significance was far greater than its political significance, which was fleeting, unlike analogous movements in third world and dictatorial countries. Yet it served as a warning, a sort of memento mori to a generation that half believed it had solved the problems of Western society for good. The major texts of Golden Age reformism, Crossland's The Future of Socialism, J.K. Galbraith's The Affluent Society, Gunnar Myrdal's Beyond the Welfare State, and Daniel Bell's The End of Ideology, all written between 1956 and 1960, rested on the presumption of the growing internal harmony of a society that was now basically satisfactory, if improvable, that is to say, on confidence in the economy of organised social consensus. That consensus did not survive the 1960s. So 1968 was neither an end nor a beginning, but only a signal. Unlike the wage explosion, the collapse of the Bretton Woods international financial system in 1971, the commodities boom of 1972 to 1973, and the OPEC oil crisis of 1973, it does not figure much in the explanation of economic historians about the end of the Golden Age. Its end was not quite unexpected. The expansion of the economy in the early 1970s, accelerated by a rapidly rising inflation, by massive rises in the world's money supplies, and the vast American deficit, became hectic. In the economists' jargon, the system became overheated. In the 12 months from July 1972, the real GDP in the OECD countries rose by 7.5%, and the real industrial production by 10%. Historians who had not forgotten the way the great mid-Victorian boom ended might well have wondered whether the system was not riding for a fall. They would have been right, though I do not think anyone predicted the fall of 1974, nor perhaps took it as seriously as it turned out to be, for, though the GNP of the advanced industrial countries actually dropped substantially, such a thing had not happened since the war, people still thought of economic crises in terms of 1929, and there was no sign of catastrophe. As usual, the immediate reaction of shocked contemporaries was to look for special reasons for the collapse of the old boom, an unusual bunching of unfortunate disturbances unlikely to be repeated on the same scale, the impact of which was compounded by some avoidable errors, to quote the OECD. The more simple-minded put it all down to the greed of the OPEC oil sheikhs. Any historian who puts major changes in the configuration of the world economy down to bad luck and avoidable accidents should think again. And this was a major change. The world economy did not recover its old stride after the crash. An era was at an end. The decades since 1973 were to be once again an age of crisis. The golden age lost its gilt. Nevertheless, it had begun, indeed it had largely achieved, the most dramatic, rapid and profound revolution in human affairs of which history has record. To this we must now turn. Chapter 10. The Social Revolution, 1945 to 1990. Lily. My grandmother would tell us things about the Depression. You can read about them too. Roy. They're always telling us that we should be glad we got food and all that, because back in the 30s they used to tell us people were starving and got no jobs and all that stuff. Bucky. I never had a depression, so it don't bother me really. Roy. From what you hear, you'd hate to live in that time. Bucky. Well, I ain't living in that time. Studs Terkel. Hard times. When General de Gaulle took power, there were 1 million television sets in France. When he left, there were 10 million. The state is always a showbiz affair. But yesterday's theatre state was a very different matter from the TV state that exists today. Régis Debray. 1. When people face what nothing in their past has prepared them for, they grope for words to name the unknown, even when they can neither define nor understand it. Sometime in the third quarter of the century, we can see this process at work among the intellectuals of the West. The key word was the small preposition after, generally used in its Latinate form post, as a prefix to any of the numerous terms which had, for some generations, been used to mark out the mental territory of 20th century life. The world, or its relevant aspects, became post-industrial, post-imperial, post-modern, post-structuralist, post-Marxist, post-Gutenberg, or whatever. Like funerals, these prefixes took official recognition of death without implying any consensus or indeed certainty about the nature of life after death. In this way, the greatest and most dramatic, rapid, and universal social transformation in human history entered the consciousness of reflective minds who lived through it. This transformation is the subject of the present chapter. The novelty of this transformation lies both in its extraordinary speed and in its universality. True, the developed parts of the world, that is to say, for practical purposes, the central and western parts of Europe and North America, plus a thin layer of the cosmopolitan rich and mighty elsewhere, had long lived in a world of constant change, technological transformation, and cultural innovation. For them, the revolution of global society meant an acceleration or intensification of movement to which they were already accustomed in principle. After all, New Yorkers of the mid-1930s already looked up to a skyscraper, the Empire State Building, 1934, whose height was not exceeded until the 1970s, and then only by a modest 30 metres or so. It took a while to notice, and even longer to take the measure of, the transformation of quantitative material growth into the qualitative upheavals of life, even in these parts of the world. But for most of the globe, the changes were both sudden and seismic. For 80% of humanity, the Middle Ages ended suddenly in the 1950s, or perhaps better still, they were felt to end in the 1960s. In many ways, those who actually lived through these transformations on the spot did not grasp their full extent, since they experienced them incrementally, or as changes in the lives of individuals which, however dramatic, are not conceived as permanent revolutions. Why should the decision of country folk to look for work in the city imply in their minds any more lasting transformation than joining the armed forces or some branch of the war economy did for British or German men and women in the two world wars? They did not intend to change their way of life for good, even if it turned out that they did. It is those who see them from outside, revisiting the scenes of such transformations at intervals, who recognize how much has changed. How utterly different, for instance, the Valencia of the early 1980s was from the same city and region in the early 1950s, when the present writer had last seen that part of Spain. How disoriented a Sicilian peasant Rip Van Winkle felt, actually a local bandit absent in jail for a couple of decades from the mid-1950s, when he returned to the environs of Palermo, which had in the meantime become unrecognizable by urban real estate development. "Where once there were vineyards, now there are palazzi," he told me, head shaking in disbelief. Indeed, the speed of change was such that historical time could be measured in even shorter intervals. Less than 10 years, 1962 to 1971, separated a Cuzco, where, outside the confines of the city, most Indian men still wore traditional costume from a Cuzco, where a substantial proportion of them already wore cholo, that is to say, European clothes. At the end of the 1970s, stallholders in the food market of a Mexican village already figured out their customers' costs on small Japanese pocket calculators, unknown there at the start of the decade. There is no way in which readers, not old and mobile enough to have seen history move in this manner since 1950, can expect to duplicate these experiences. Although, since the 1960s, when young Westerners discovered that travel to third world countries was both feasible and fashionable, all it has taken to watch global transformation is an open pair of eyes. In any case, historians cannot remain content with images and anecdotes, however significant. They need to specify and to count. The most dramatic and far-reaching social change of the second half of this century, and the one which cuts us off forever from the world of the past, is the death of the peasantry. For since the Neolithic era, most human beings had lived off the land and its livestock, or harvested the sea as fishers. With the exception of Britain, peasants and farmers remained a massive part of the occupied population, even in industrialized countries, until well into the 20th century. So much so that in the present writer's student days, the 1930s, the refusal of the peasantry to fade away was still currently used as an argument against Karl Marx's prediction that they would. After all, on the eve of the Second World War, there was only one industrial country in addition to Britain where agriculture and fisheries employed less than 20% of the population, namely Belgium. Even in Germany and the USA, the greatest industrial economies, where the agricultural population had indeed been declining steadily, it still amounted to roughly a quarter. In France, Sweden, and Austria, it was still between 35 and 40%. As for backward agrarian countries, say in Europe, Bulgaria, or Romania, something like 4 out of every 5 inhabitants worked on the land. Yet consider what happened in the third quarter of the century. It is perhaps not too surprising that by the early 1980s, less than 3 out of every 100 Britons or Belgians were in agriculture, so that the average Briton was far more likely in the course of everyday life to encounter a person who had once farmed in India or Bangladesh than one who actually farmed in the United Kingdom. The farming population of the USA had fallen to the same percentage, but given its long-term steep decline, this was less astonishing than the fact that this tiny fraction of the labour force was in a position to flood the USA and the world with untold quantities of food. What few would have expected in the 1940s was that by the early 1980s, no country west of the Iron Curtain borders had more than 10% of its population engaged in farming, except the Irish Republic, which was only a little above this figure, and the Iberian states. But the very fact that in Spain and Portugal, people in agriculture, who had formed just under half the population in 1950, were reduced to 14.5% and 17.6% respectively 30 years later speaks for itself. The Spanish peasantry was halved in the 20 years after 1950, the Portuguese in the 20 years after 1960. These are spectacular figures. In Japan, for instance, farmers were reduced from 52.4% of the people in 1947 to 9% in 1985. That is to say, between the time that a young soldier returned from the battles of the Second World War and the time he retired from his subsequent civilian career. In Finland, to take an actual life history known to the writer, a girl born as a farmer's daughter and who became a farmer's working wife in her first marriage could, before she had got far into middle age, have transformed herself into a cosmopolitan intellectual and political figure. But then, in 1940, when her father died in the Winter War against Russia, leaving mother and infant on the family holding, 57% of Finns were farmers and foresters. By the time she was 45, less than 10% were. What is more natural than that under such circumstances, Finns should begin on farms and end in very different circumstances? Yet if Marx's prediction that industrialization would eliminate the peasantry was at last evidently coming true in countries of headlong industrialization, the really extraordinary development was the decline of the farming population in countries whose obvious lack of such development the United Nations tried to disguise by a variety of euphemisms for the words backward and poor. At the very moment when hopeful young leftists were quoting Mao Zedong's strategy for the triumph of revolution by mobilizing the countless rural millions against the encircled urban strongholds of the status quo, these millions were abandoning their villages and moving into the cities themselves. In Latin America, the percentage of peasants halved in 20 years in Colombia, 1951 to 1973. In Mexico, 1960 to 1980, and almost in Brazil, 1960 to 1980. It fell by two-thirds, or almost two-thirds, in the Dominican Republic, 1960 to 1981, Venezuela, 1961 to 1981, and Jamaica, 1953 to 1981. All these, except Venezuela, were countries in which, at the end of the Second World War, peasants had formed half or an absolute majority of the occupied population. But as early as the 1970s, there was, in Latin America, outside the mini-states of the Central American land strip and Haiti, no country in which peasants were not a minority. The situation was similar in the countries of Western Islam. Algeria slimmed its agriculturals from 75% of the population to 20%, Tunisia from 68% to 23% in just over 30 years. Morocco, less dramatically, lost its peasant majority in 1971 to 1982. Syria and Iraq still had about half their people on the land in the mid-1950s. Within about 20 years, the first had halved this percentage, the second reduced it to less than one-third. Iran dropped from about 55% of peasants in the mid-1950s to 29% in the mid-1980s. Meanwhile, of course, the peasants of agrarian Europe stopped tilling the land. By the 1980s, even the ancient strongholds of peasant agriculture in the east and southeast of the continent had no more than a third or so of their labour force in farming, Romania, Poland, Yugoslavia, Greece, and some had considerably less, notably Bulgaria, 16.5% in 1985. Only one peasant stronghold remained in or around the neighbourhood of Europe and the Middle East, Turkey, where the peasantry declined, but in the mid-1980s still remained an absolute majority. Only three regions of the globe remained essentially dominated by their villages and fields: sub-Saharan Africa, South and continental Southeast Asia, and China. In these regions alone was it still possible to find countries which the decline of the cultivators had apparently passed by, where those who grew crops and looked after animals remained throughout the stormy decades a steady proportion of the population, over 90% in Nepal, about 70% in Liberia, about 60% in Ghana, or even, a somewhat surprising fact, 70% or so in India through the 25 years after independence, and barely less, 66.4%, even in 1981. Admittedly, these regions of peasant dominance still represented half the human race at the end of our period. However, even they were crumbling at the edges under the pressures of economic development. The solid peasant bloc of India was surrounded by countries whose farming populations were visibly declining quite fast: Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka, where peasants have long ceased to be a majority, as they had by the 1980s in Malaysia, the Philippines, and Indonesia, and, of course, in the new industrial states of East Asia, Taiwan, and South Korea, which had more than 60% of its people in the fields as recently as 1961. Moreover, in Africa, the peasant predominance of several southern countries was a Bantustan illusion. Farming, mostly conducted by the women, was the visible side of an economy which actually depended largely on the remittances of male migrant labour to the white cities and mines in the south. The strange thing about this massive and silent exodus from the land in the greater part of the world's landmass, and even more of its islands, is that it was only partly due to agricultural progress, at least in the former peasant areas. As we have seen, the developed industrial countries, with one or two exceptions, also transformed themselves into the major producers of agricultural goods for the world market, and they did so while reducing their actual farming population to a steadily diminishing and sometimes an absurdly tiny percentage of their people. This was plainly achieved by an extraordinary spurt in capital-intensive productivity per head of the agriculturalists. Its most immediately visible aspect was the sheer quantity of machinery which the farmer in rich and developed countries now had at his or her disposal, and which realized the great dreams of plenty through mechanized agriculture that inspired all those symbolic bare-chested tractor drivers in the propaganda photos of the young Soviet Republic, and which Soviet agriculture so signally failed to live up to. Less visible but equally significant were the increasingly impressive achievements of agricultural chemistry, selective breeding, and biotechnology. Under these conditions, farming simply no longer needed the numbers of hands and arms, without which in pre-technological days a harvest could not be got in, nor indeed the number of regular farm families and their permanent servants. And where they were needed, modern transport made it unnecessary to keep them in the country. Thus, in the 1970s, sheep farmers in Perthshire, Scotland, found it cost-effective to import expert specialist shearers from New Zealand for the short local shearing season, which naturally did not coincide with that in the southern hemisphere. In the poor regions of the world, the agricultural revolution was not absent, though it was patchier. Indeed, but for irrigation and the input of science through the so-called Green Revolution, controversial though the long-term consequences of both may be, large parts of South and Southeast Asia would have been unable to feed a rapidly multiplying population. Yet on the whole, the countries of the Third World and parts of the formerly or still socialist Second World no longer fed themselves, let alone produced the major exportable food surplus that might be expected from agrarian countries. At best, they were encouraged to concentrate on specialized export crops for the market of the developed world, while their peasants, when not buying the dumped surpluses of export food from the north, went on hoeing and ploughing in the old labor-intensive manner. There were no good reasons why they should have left an agriculture which needed their labor, except perhaps the population explosion which might make land scarcer. But the regions out of which the peasants flooded were often, as in Latin America, quite thinly settled, and tended to have open frontiers to which a small proportion of the countrymen migrated as squatters and free settlers, often, as in Colombia and Peru, providing the political base for local guerrilla movements. Conversely, the Asian regions in which the peasantry maintained itself best was perhaps the most densely settled zone in the world, with densities per square mile ranging from 250 to 2,000. The average for South America is 41.5. When the land empties, the cities fill up. The world of the second half of the 20th century became urbanized as never before. By the mid-1980s, 42% of its population were urban. And, but for the weight of the enormous rural populations of China and India, which kept three-quarters of Asia's countrymen, it would have been a majority. But even in the rural heartlands, people shifted from country to city, and especially to the great city. Between 1960 and 1980, the urban population of Kenya doubled, though in 1980 it had only reached 14.2%, but almost 6 out of every 10 townsmen now lived in Nairobi, whereas 20 years earlier only 4 out of 10 had done so. In Asia, the multi-million city mushroomed, generally a capital. Seoul, Tehran, Karachi, Jakarta, Manila, New Delhi, Bangkok all had between roughly 5 and 8.5 million inhabitants in 1980 and were expected to have between 10 and 13.5 million in the year 2000. In 1950, not one of them, except Jakarta, had more than about 1.5 millions each. Indeed, by far the most gigantic urban agglomerations at the end of the 1980s were to be found in the Third World: Cairo, Mexico City, Sao Paulo, and Shanghai, whose populations were counted in 8 figures. For paradoxically, while the developed world remained far more urbanized than the poor world, except for parts of Latin America and the Islamic zone, its own giant cities were dissolving. They had reached their peak in the early 20th century, before the flight to suburbs and satellite out-of-town communities gained speed, and the old city centres became hollow shells at night when the workers, shoppers and seekers after entertainment had gone home. While Mexico City almost quintupled in the 30 years after 1950, New York, London and Paris slowly drifted out of or to the lower edges of the big league of cities. Yet, in a curious way, both the old and the new worlds converged. The typical great city of the developed world became a region of linked urban settlements, generally focused on some central area or areas of business or administration, recognizable from the air as a sort of mountain range of high-rise buildings and skyscrapers, except where, as in Paris, such building was not permitted. Their interconnection, or perhaps the breakdown of private motor traffic under the pressure of massive automobile ownership, was demonstrated from the 1960s by a new revolution in public transport. Never since the first construction of urban streetcar and underground railway systems in the late 19th century had so many new subway and rapid suburban transit systems been built in so many places, from Vienna to San Francisco, from Seoul to Mexico. At the same time, decentralization spread as most component communities or suburban complexes developed their own shopping and leisure services, notably through the American-pioneered peripheral shopping malls. On the other hand, the Third World city, though also bound together by usually obsolete and inadequate public transport systems and a myriad of broken-down private buses and collective taxis, could not but be scattered and unstructured, if only because there is no way in which agglomerations of 10 to 20 million people cannot be so, especially if much of their component settlements have begun life as low-built shantytowns, as like as not established by groups of squatters on some unused open space. The inhabitants of such cities may have to spend several hours a day travelling to and from employment, for regular work is precious, and they may be willing to make pilgrimages of equal length to places of public ritual like Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium, 200,000 seats, where cariocas worship the divinities of futebol. But in fact, both old and new world conurbations were increasingly collections of nominally, or in the case of the West, often formally, autonomous communities, though in the rich West, at least on the outskirts, they contained far more green spaces than in the poor or overcrowded East and South. While in the slums and shantytowns, humans lived in symbiosis with the hardy rat and roach, the strange no-man's land between town and country that surrounded what was left of the inner cities of the developed world was colonized by the fauna of the wilds, weasel, fox and raccoon. 2. Almost as dramatic as the decline and fall of the peasantry, and much more universal, was the rise of the occupations which required secondary and higher education. Universal primary education, that is to say, basic literacy, was indeed the aspiration of virtually all governments, so much so that by the late 1980s, only the most honest or helpless states admitted to having as many as half their population illiterate, and only 10, all but Afghanistan in Africa, were prepared to concede that less than 20% of their population could read and write. And literacy made striking progress, not least in the revolutionary countries under communist rule, whose achievements in this respect were indeed most impressive, even when the claims to have liquidated illiteracy within some implausibly short spell of time were sometimes optimistic. Yet, whether or not mass literacy was general, the demand for places in secondary and especially in higher education multiplied at an extraordinary rate, and so did the numbers of people who had undergone it or were undergoing it. This explosion of numbers was particularly dramatic in university education, hitherto so unusual as to be demographically negligible, except in the USA. Before the Second World War, even Germany, France, and Britain, three of the largest, most developed, and educated countries, with a total population of 150 millions, contained no more than 150,000 or so university students between them, or 0.1% of their joint populations. Yet, by the late 1980s, students were counted in millions in France, the Federal Republic of Germany, Italy, Spain, and the USSR, to name only European countries, not to mention Brazil, India, Mexico, the Philippines, and of course the USA, which had been the pioneer of mass college education. By this time, in educationally ambitious countries, students formed upwards of 2.5% of the total population, men, women, and children, or even in exceptional cases above 3%. It was not uncommon for 20% of the 20 to 24 age group to be in formal education. Even the academically most conservative countries, Britain and Switzerland, had risen to 1.5%. Moreover, some of the relatively largest student bodies were to be found in economically far from advanced countries: Ecuador, 3.2%, the Philippines, 2.7%, or Peru, 2%. All this was not merely new, but quite sudden. The most striking fact from the study of Latin American university students in the middle 1960s is that they were so few in number, U.S. scholars wrote during that decade, convinced that this echoed the basic elitist European model of higher education south of the Rio Grande. And this in spite of the fact that their numbers had been growing by about 8% a year. In fact, not until the 1960s was it undeniable that students had become, both socially and politically, a far more important force than ever before, for in 1968 the worldwide uprisings of student radicalism spoke louder than statistics. But these also became impossible to overlook. Between 1960 and 1980, to stick to well-schooled Europe, the number of students tripled or quadrupled in the most typical country, except where it multiplied by 4 to 5, as in federal Germany, Ireland, and Greece, by 5 to 7, as in Finland, Iceland, Sweden, and Italy, and 7 to 9-fold, as in Spain and Norway. At first sight, it seems curious that, on the whole, the rush into the universities was less marked in the socialist countries, in spite of their pride in mass education, though the case of Mao's China is aberrant. The great helmsman virtually abolished all higher education during the Cultural Revolution, 1966 to 1976. As the troubles of the socialist systems grew in the 1970s and 1980s, they fell further behind the West. Hungary and Czechoslovakia had a smaller percentage of their populations in higher education than practically all other European states. Does it seem quite as curious at second sight? Perhaps not. The extraordinary growth of higher education, which by the early 1980s produced at least 7 countries with more than 100,000 teachers at university level, was due to consumer pressure to which socialist systems were not geared to respond. It was obvious to planners and governments that the modern economy required far more administrators, teachers, and technical experts than in the past, who had to be trained somewhere. And universities or similar institutions of higher education had, by ancient tradition, functioned largely as training schools for public service and the specialized professions. But while this, as well as a general democratic bias, justified a substantial expansion of higher education, the scale of the student explosion far exceeded what rational planning might have envisaged. In fact, where families had the choice and the chance, they rushed their children into higher education, because it was by far the best way of winning them a better income, but above all, higher social status. Of the Latin American students interviewed by U.S. investigators in the mid-1960s in various countries, between 79 and 95% were convinced that study would put them into a higher social class within 10 years. Only between 21 and 38% felt that it would win them a much higher economic status than their families. In fact, of course, it would almost certainly give them a higher income than non-graduates, and in countries of small education, where the certificate of graduation guaranteed a place in the state machine and therefore power, influence and financial extortion, it could be the key to real wealth. Most students, of course, came from families that were better off than most. How otherwise could they have afforded to pay for some years' study by young adults of working age, but not necessarily rich? Often the sacrifices their parents made were real. The Korean educational miracle, it was said, rested on the carcasses of cows sold by small farmers to push their children into the honoured and privileged ranks of scholars. In 8 years, 1975 to 1983, Korean students rose from 0.8% to almost 3% of the population. No one who has the experience of being the first in his family to go to university full-time will have any difficulty in understanding their motivations. The great world boom made it possible for countless modest families, white-collar employees and public officials, shopkeepers and small businessmen, farmers in the West, even prosperous skilled workers, to afford full-time study for their children. The Western welfare state, starting with the US subsidies for ex-service students after 1945, provided substantial student aid in one way or another, though most students still expected a distinctly unluxurious life. In democratic and egalitarian countries, something like a right for graduates of secondary schools to move to higher things was often accepted, to the point where in France, selective admission to a state university was still regarded as constitutionally impossible in 1991. No such right existed in the socialist countries. As young men and women surged into higher education, governments, for outside the USA, Japan and a few other countries, universities were overwhelmingly public rather than private institutions, multiplied new establishments to take them in, especially in the 1970s, when the number of the world's universities more than doubled. And of course, the newly independent ex-colonies, which multiplied during the 1960s, insisted on their own institutions of higher education as a symbol of independence, as they insisted on a flag, an airline, or an army. These masses of young men and women and their teachers, counted in millions or at least in hundreds of thousands, in all except the very smallest or the exceptionally backward states, increasingly concentrated in large and often isolated campuses or university cities, were a novel factor in both culture and politics. They were transnational, moving and communicating ideas and experiences across frontiers with ease and speed, and were probably more at ease than governments with the technology of communications. As the 1960s revealed, they were not only politically radical and explosive, but uniquely effective in giving national, even international expression to political and social discontent. In dictatorial countries, they usually provided the only bodies of citizens capable of collective political action, and it is far from insignificant that, while other Latin American student populations swelled, their number in the military dictator Pinochet's Chile after 1973 was made to drop, from 1.5 to 1.1% of the population. And if there was a single moment in the golden years after 1945 which corresponds to the world simultaneous upheaval of which the revolutionaries had dreamed after 1917, it was surely 1968, when students rebelled from the USA and Mexico in the West to socialist Poland, Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, largely stimulated by the extraordinary outbreak of May 1968 in Paris, epicentre of a continent-wide student uprising. It was far from revolution, though it was considerably more than the psychodrama or street theatre which unsympathetic senior observers like Raymond Aron dismissed. After all, 1968 ended the era of General de Gaulle in France, the era of democratic presidents in the USA, the hopes of liberal communism in communist Central Europe, and, through the silent after-effects of the student massacre of Tlatelolco, it marked the beginning of a new era in Mexican politics. The reason why 1968, with its prolongation into 1969 and 1970, was not the revolution, and never looked as though it would be or could be, was that students alone, however numerous and mobilizable, could not make one alone. their political effectiveness rested on their ability to act as signals and detonators for larger but less easily combustible groups. Since the 1960s, students have sometimes succeeded in doing so. They sparked off enormous working-class strike waves in France and Italy in 1968 to 1969, but after 20 years of unparalleled improvement for wage earners in economies of full employment, revolution was the last thing in the minds of the proletarian masses. Not until the 1980s, and then in non-democratic countries as widely different as China, South Korea, and Czechoslovakia, did student rebellions look like realizing their potential for detonating revolution, or at least to force governments to treat them like a serious public danger by massacring them on a large scale, as in Tiananmen Square, Beijing. After the failure of the Great Dreams of 1968, some student radicals did indeed attempt to make revolution on their own by small group terrorism, but though such movements received a great deal of publicity, thus achieving at least one of their major objectives, they rarely had any serious political impact. Where they threatened to have, they were fairly rapidly suppressed once the authorities decided to act. In the 1970s, with unexampled brutality and systematic torture in dirty wars in South America, with bribery and backstairs negotiations in Italy. The only significant survivors of these initiatives in the last decade of the century were the Basque nationalist terrorist ETA and the theoretically communist peasant guerrilla Sendero Luminoso in Peru, an undesired gift of the staff and students of the University of Ayacucho to their countrymen. Nevertheless, this leaves us with a slightly puzzling question. Why did the movement of this new social group of students, alone among the new or old social actors of the golden era, opt for a radicalism of the left? For, if we leave aside rebels against the communist regimes, even nationalist student movements tended to stitch the red badge of Marx, Lenin, or Mao somewhere on their banners until the 1980s. In some ways, this inevitably takes us well beyond social stratification, for the new student body was, by definition, also an age group of youth, that is to say, a temporary halting place on the human passage through life, and it also contained a rapidly growing and disproportionately large component of women, suspended between the impermanence of their age and the permanence of their sex. Later, we shall consider the development of special youth cultures which linked students to others of their generation and the new women's consciousness, which also reached out beyond the universities. Youth groups, not yet settled in established adulthood, are the traditional locus for high spirits, riot and disorder, as even medieval university rectors knew, and revolutionary passions are more common at 18 than at 35, as generations of bourgeois parents in Europe had told generations of sceptical sons and, later, daughters. In fact, this belief was so ingrained in Western cultures that the establishment in several countries, perhaps mostly Latin ones on either side of the Atlantic, entirely discounted student militancy even to the point of armed guerrilla struggle in the younger generation. If anything, it was a sign of a spirited rather than a torpid personality. Students from San Marcos in Lima, Peru, as the joke went, did their revolutionary service in some ultra-Maoist sect before settling down to a solid and unpolitical middle-class profession, while such a thing as normal life still continued in that unhappy country. Mexican students soon learned that the state and party apparatus essentially recruited its cadres from the university and, B, that the more revolutionary they were as students, the better the jobs they were likely to be offered after graduation. But even in respectable France, the ex-Maoist of the early 1970s who made a brilliant career in the state service became familiar. Nevertheless, this does not explain why bodies of young people who were obviously on the way to a far better future than their parents, or at any rate than most non-students, should have, with rare exceptions, been attracted by political radicalism. Indeed, a high proportion of them probably were not, preferring to concentrate on getting the degrees which guaranteed their future, though they were less noticeable than the smaller but still numerically large number of the politically active, especially when these dominated the visible parts of university life by means of public demonstrations ranging from graffiti and poster-filled walls to meetings, marches and pickets. Still, even this degree of left-wing radicalism was new in the developed countries, though not in the backward and dependent ones. Before the Second World War, the great majority of students in Central and Western Europe and North America had been non-political or right-wing. The sheer explosion of student numbers suggests a possible answer. The number of French students at the end of the Second World War was less than 100,000. By 1960, it was over 200,000, and within the next 10 years, it tripled to 651,000. During these 10 years, the number of students in the humanities multiplied by almost 3.5, the number of students in the social sciences by 4. The most immediate and direct consequence was an inevitable tension between these masses of mainly first-generation students, now suddenly pouring into universities and institutions which were neither physically nor organizationally and intellectually prepared for such an influx. Moreover, as a growing proportion of the age group had the chance to study, in France it was 4% in 1950, 15.5% in 1970, going to university ceased to be an exceptional privilege which was its own reward, and the constraints it imposed on young and generally impecunious adults were more resented. Resentment of one kind of authority, the universities, easily broadened out into resentment of any authority, and therefore, in the West, inclined students to the left. It is not at all surprising that the 1960s became the decade of student unrest par excellence. Special reasons intensified it in this or that country: hostility to the Vietnam War in the USA, that is to say, to military service, racial resentment in Peru. But the phenomenon was too general to need special ad hoc explanations. And yet, in a more general, less definable sense, this new mass of students stood, as it were, at an awkward angle to the rest of society. Unlike other and older established classes or social groupings, they had no established place in it or pattern of relations to it. For how could the new student armies be compared to the relatively tiny pre-war bodies, 40,000 in well-educated 1939 Germany, who were merely a junior phase of middle-class life? In many ways, the very existence of the new masses implied questions about the society that had engendered them, and from questions to criticism is but one step. How did they fit into it? What sort of society was it? The very youth of the student body, the very width of the generation gap between these children of the post-war world and the parents who remembered and compared, made their questions more urgent, their attitude more critical. For the discontents of the young were not blanketed by the consciousness of living through times of staggering improvement, far better times than their parents had ever expected to see. The new times were the only ones that the young men and women who went to college knew. On the contrary, they felt things could be different and better, even when they did not quite know how. Their elders, used to, or at least remembering, times of hardship and unemployment, did not expect mass radical mobilizations at a time when, surely, the economic incentive for them in the developed countries was less than ever before. But the explosion of student unrest erupted at the very peak of the great global boom because it was directed, however vaguely and blindly, against what they saw as characteristic of this society, not against the fact that the older society might not have improved quite enough. But paradoxically, the fact that the impetus for the new radicalism came from groups unaffected by economic discontent stimulated even the groups used to mobilize on an economic basis to discover that, after all, they could ask for far more from the new society than they had imagined. The most immediate effect of the European student rebellion was a wave of working-class strikes for higher wages and better conditions.